I'm going to make you feel really insignificant, but don't worry, then I'm going to turn around and make you feel significant again, okay? My brother wrote on Facebook last night that if you made a scale model of the solar system and the Earth was one of those big softballs, the sun was a big softball, the Earth would be a grain of sand back there in the lobby. And then, of course, you're one of 7 billion tiny little dots crawling around on that grain of sand, you know. And the nearest star would be another ball of similar size 2,000 miles away. So that's a scale model of the universe. Now, the part that's amazing is that God looked at that grain of sand, and it says that to him, in 2 Peter, it says, to God, 1,000 years are like a day, and a day are like 1,000 years. It doesn't say in the Bible, but I got to think that to him, 1,000 meters is, you know, a micron, and a micron is 1,000 meters. Maybe I should use inches and miles and stuff, but you get the idea, right? Yes. And so your significance is as great as a baby being held in a mother's arms. I mean, if you think about the intensity of that relationship, that's the relationship God has for you, and that's how much he cares for you individually. Sometimes in the Bible, there are very specific stories about individuals. Today, though, I want to talk about a story in the Old Testament that's about the entire nation of Israel. There weren't 7 billion people in the world then, but still, they were still a small part of the people on the earth at the time, but they were God's chosen people and as precious to him as that infant. Sometimes the things that happen to them as a people are instructive to what we can do as a person. So I'm going to talk about the story of the people of Israel, but I want you to be thinking the whole time, well, so does this apply to me somehow? And hopefully I can help you see that it does, okay? There's a battle for our soul. You know, one of the most famous books of all time was Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. They used to say it was the biggest selling book. I think Stephen King or somebody passed him now. Maybe you've read it. It's really good. I recommend it. It's a metaphor in Pilgrim's Progress of the journey of the Christian life. But John Bunyan wrote another book called The Holy War. My copy's kind of all ripped up and everything, but The Holy War, the metaphor there is there's a city of Mansoul, and the city of Mansoul is a walled, fortressed city, and they're assaulted by Diabolus, the devil, right? And all the different characters in Mansoul, the mayor and all the other people, represent different parts of a person's soul, of their personality, of their knowledge, of their good habits and their bad habits, and that sort of thing. And the kinds of things that we see when the soul is tarnished, Christians have often tried to make lists that kind of summarize, and they call, you've heard of the seven deadly sins. Well, there's no exact. There's nothing in the Bible about seven exact deadly sins, and but the ones that in modern language would be lust, gluttony, greed, sloth. We don't use much anymore, but sloth would be like apathy. Oh yeah, like I give, you know, or what is it? Whatever,
whatever.
Yeah. Whatever. Rage. I thought of road rage. When I thought of all kinds of rage, anger, fighting, bitterness, envy, wanting stuff other people have, and pride. Pride's a really big one. So when God is reforming the nation of Israel in the Old Testament,
that night, all of them,
greed, sloth, rage, pride, he wants to get rid of those things among the nation of Israel. And when he's reforming us, and he's constantly reforming us. It's not something that happens when you get saved, okay? He's constantly reforming us, and those are the things he wants to remove from our lives. The story that takes place is in the time of the judges, and I'll just give you a short historical background. I mentioned, I think last time I preached, that Abraham had Isaac, Isaac had Jacob, Jacob had 12 sons. His whole family moved to Egypt for 400 years. Then they came back and they went into the promised land. And the promised land is not a type of heaven, it's a type of the Christian life. Joshua was the Moses led them to the promised land. Joshua led them into the promised land after a 40-year delay while they let a whole generation die off. And they succeeded in large measure in occupying the land that God had given them. I say in large measure because God promised them the land that the Canaanites were in, and the Canaanites were, as the Jebusites, and blah, blah, blah. There are a bunch of tribes that own chunks of that land, and in general known for things like burning their children alive as worship to God. So he wanted them to completely eliminate the Canaanites. They tried. They failed. He told them to never make a treaty with them. They failed in that also. They decided, well, if we can't get rid of them all, at least we can make some use out of them. So they made them into slaves. I saw it one time as carriers of wood and hewers of wood and carriers of water. I think when you go to Africa, you realize, man, a whole bunch of your day is spent just getting fuel and water in that kind of less technological age. And God was very disappointed with them for not following his command. He was giving them the strength, but for whatever reason, they gave up before they finished the job. In Judges chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land I swore to give your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? I have also said, I will not drive them out before you. They will become traps for you, and their gods will become snares to you.'" Right after they entered the land, they were following God pretty well while Joshua was still alive. And I think he lived to be 125 years old or something like that. But when he died, it varied depending on what kind of leader came up. Now, the Bible, they call them judges. But when we think judge, we're thinking of a legal role kind of thing. So a better word would be leader. And you might say, well, okay, but if it's a leader of the whole nation, what's the difference between that and a king? Well, a leader has to have followers. A king has subjects, all right? So you're required to obey the king. With the leaders, they said, follow me, let's go. And there were 14 different judges over a period of 200 or 300 years. And what would happen is a judge would come up, lead the people, they'd reform the nation, turn to God. Things would be good, and then that leader would fall out of favor or die, and people would start to go their own way, and they would begin to worship the gods of the Canaanites and forget all about Almighty God, Yahweh. And that went on through these 14 cycles over a period of 200 or 300 years. And God allowed them at times when they began to follow those other gods, little g gods, he allowed them to be conquered and enslaved over and over again by the people around them or some of those Canaanites that are still within them. He says, I forgot to put the verse down, he says in Judges, God says, I'm going to leave, those people are going to be a thorn in your side, and I'm going to use them to test you and see whether you really love me or not. Kind of harsh, right? But that was his, you know, if you're not going to follow me wholeheartedly, I'm going to let you be tested in this way. Okay, now the story I'm about to read is full of violence and sex, and it's in the Bible, all right? I'm going to read the Bible to you. So Marcy always makes fun of me, saying I do it on purpose. I think it's because, and maybe I do, I don't know, but I think it's mostly because I like to teach out of the Old Testament. Man, the Old Testament is just full of this stuff. And and some of it's pretty shocking, and I think it's meant to shock us. So go ahead and be shocked. It's kind of like when Dave had us yell, "Crucify him." We're all like, "Oh, that doesn't feel too good." Get your attention, right? You know. So let's see. I'm getting back to Judges, chapter 19. There's a Levite, and I'm just going to tell you about chapter 19. I'll read some from chapter 20. So those 12 tribes were named after the 12 sons of Jacob. Levi was one of those sons. Levites were a tribe, and they were the ones that the priests came out of, and the servants in the temple, or the tent at that time, the tent of worship. And then the other, right in the, that particular Levite lived in the area that Ephraim was another one of those sons. And then his concubine, what's a concubine, okay? That's another word we don't use too often. I thought, it's a moving target. When I was a kid, I think we would have said his mistress. And it would have implied that it was a woman he had sex with, he lived with, he spent time with and supported, but she had no legal status as a wife, okay? And that still kind of exists, but it's getting to the point now where there's so many people are unmarried and having kids and everything that I don't think we have a really good concept of what a concubine is. It depends on a strong concept of what marriage is. Anyways, concubine ran away from him. And she ran all the way to Bethlehem, which was like 30 miles from where he was in Ephraim. And she ran back to her mom. They went to get her. And he talked her into coming back with him. She said, okay. So, but her dad, she was staying at her mom and dad's, her dad didn't want her to leave, and he kept just, come on, stay one more day, you know, have a meal. Let's just another day. And this went on for days, right? And even finally, the day the Levite said, I'm leaving, doggone it, he said, well, just at least stay for lunch, you know? So he had to walk 30 miles to get back, roughly 30 miles to get back to his home. It says it's out in the hill country somewhere. And here he is in Bethlehem, right next to Jerusalem. And when he finally leaves, it's already afternoon. And that's why he only gets as far as Jebus. What's Jebus? Well, before the sun starts to set. Jebus is the leftover Canaanites of the Jebusites. And the whole city of Jerusalem was the city of Jebus. So before the Jews took over Jerusalem, it was Jebus. After they took it over, they squeezed them out and they had this little town. And so when the Levite and his concubine got there, and he had some servants traveling with him, the servant said, well, let's camp out here. You know, the practice was you go to the town square, you camp out, and if somebody's nice, they invite you to come stay in their house and you can have a meal with them or whatever and sleep under a roof. Well, this Levite's pretty wary, so he goes, no, let's not stay there, man. Let's go to where there's some Israelites. I want have somebody have my back. So they marched on, not very far apparently, because now it's getting to be nighttime. It was already late when they went through Jebus. And I'm blanking on the name of the... They get to Gibeah. And Gibeah is in a tiny little part of Israel. And Israel's a small country to begin with. It's about three times the size of the Willamette Valley in Oregon. Or it's about the size of the state of New Jersey, you know. And he had only gone, he'd walked just a few miles to get from Bethlehem to Gibeah. But Gibeah and Bethlehem and Jerusalem and Gibeah were both in the area controlled by the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin, the youngest son. Well, there's this weird story. And it's very similar to the story in Genesis, where two angels plus God's angel talk to Abraham and then go down into the city of Sodom to talk to Lot. And they go into Lot's house, and all these men get around the house and are banging on the door and yelling, saying, "Bring them out, we want to have sex with them." Gang rape. Okay? And what happened here, this is hundreds of years later, a very similar thing. The Levite goes into Gibeah, he's at the town square, a nice guy invites him to come spend the night in his house. A bunch of the men of the city of Gibeah surround the house, start yelling, "Bring him out, we want to have sex with him." And like the people in the story in Genesis, the host and the guy say, "Well, look, you can have," the host says, "you can have my daughter," and the guy goes, "you can have my concubine." Pretty tacky, right? We don't see that. We're like, "Well, no, you go out and fight." But you got to, I think it shows something about how much Christianity, first Judaism and now Christianity, have impacted the world. Because that just would have been normal stuff in the world at that time. And there are places in the world, unfortunately, where it still would be normal. So the idea that a woman was worth so little that, I mean, it was a bummer to lose your concubine, but still, that's better, you know, that's better in their mind. So they put the concubine out. She's gang raped. And she's gang raped so much that she crawls up to the door afterwards and dies. Pretty hideous story. It only gets worse. The Levite is so outraged that this has happened, and it's happened to him in Israel, where he thought he had his brothers had his back, that he cuts her into 12 pieces and sends one piece to each of the 12 tribes and says, "Everybody gather together. We need to take care of this problem in Gibeah." And among those that they talk with are the Benjamites. This is a town in their territory. And basically what all the Israelites say is, "Give us those guys that did that." And the Benjamites said no. And they said, "Well, we'll wipe out the whole town of Gibeah then." And they said, "No, you won't. We'll fight you. We're not going to let you do that." So for whatever reason, they stuck up for these jerks that surrounded the house and gang raped the concubine to death. They stood up for the town. They banded together as an entire tribe and fought the other 11 tribes. The Benjamites got together 26,000 swordsmen. And when they say swordsmen, it's like guys who knew how to fight. One of the things that God said when he said, "I'm going to leave the Canaanites as a thorn in your side," he said, "I'm going to leave them there. One of the reasons is so you'll learn how to fight, because you'll be fighting all the time." So these were guys who knew how to fight. And just to show their, I think maybe this is included to show the unity with the city of Gibeah, it mentions that there were 700 elite troops, kind of like the Navy SEALs or the Green Berets of the time, that were from Gibeah, that could throw a rock out of a sling and hit a hare and, you know, stuff like that. So they were this really strong, well-trained force. But they were only one tribe out of 12, so the other 11 tribes got together 400,000 swordsmen. And they went to fight, the Benjamites and the other 11 tribes went to fight right there at Gibeah, the town where the atrocity happened. I think I'll take a drink of water first of all. Usually it doesn't take as long to read a few verses as you might think. So I'm going to read chapter 20, verses 12 through 48. The tribes of Israel sent messengers throughout the tribe of Benjamin saying, "What about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now turn those wicked men of Gibeah over to us so we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel." But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their towns, in addition to 700 able young men, those living in Gibeah. Among all these soldiers, there were 700 who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 swordsmen, all of them fighting men. The Israelites went up to Bethel, house of God, and inquired of God. They said, "Who of us is to go up first to fight among the fight against the Benjamites?" The Lord replied, "Judah shall go first." The next morning, the Israelites got up and pitched camp near Gibeah. The Israelites went out to fight the Benjamites and took up battle positions against them at Gibeah. The Benjamites came out of Gibeah and cut down 22,000 Israelites on the battlefield that day. Wait, didn't God just tell them to go fight? But the Israelites encouraged each other and again took up their positions where they had stationed themselves the first day. The Israelites went up and... Whoops, I skipped a part, sorry. The Israelites went up and wept before the Lord until evening, and they inquired of the Lord. They said, "Shall we go up to fight against the Benjamites, our fellow Israelites?" So this time they're being more specific, right? Before it's like, who should we send first, God? They knew they were supposed to fight. And God apparently thought so too, because he said, send Judah. This time they're saying, so should we go up and fight? And the Lord answered, "Go up against them." Then the Israelites drew near to Benjamin the second day. This time, when the Benjamites came out from Gibeah to oppose them, they cut down another 18,000 Israelites. So they're down 40,000 men in 2 days of fighting, trying to defeat these 26,000 guys who are defending an outrage at God's command. Weird story. That's why I picked it. Okay. So then all the Israelites, the whole army, went up to Bethel, and there they sat weeping before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord. And the Israelites inquired of the Lord. In those days, the Ark of the Covenant of God was there with Phinehas, son of Eleazar, and the son of Aaron ministering before it. They asked, "Shall we go up again to fight against the Benjamites, our fellow Israelites, or not?" So now they've really narrowed it down. We're going to fight, and is it Benjamites, or is it a not? So they've gotten more and more specific with the prayer. And God says, the Lord responded, "Go, for tomorrow I will give them into your hands." Then Israel set an ambush around Gibeah. They went up against the Benjamites on the third day and took up positions against Gibeah as they had done before. The Benjamites came out to meet them and were drawn away from the city, Gibeah. They began to inflict casualties on the Israelites as before, so that about 30 of them fell in the open field and on the roads, the one leading to Bethel and the other to Gibeah. While the Benjamites were saying, "We are defeating them as before," the Israelites were saying, "Let's retreat and draw them away from the city to the roads." Now, they don't always put things in exact chronological order in Hebrew stories. I don't know why that is. But if you read in that general area, you find out that they had a plan to have an ambush. So they sent 10,000 guys up to fight out of this big army. And then they kind of fell back. They lost about 30 men while they're falling back. But then the other guys... boom, they went into Gibeah behind the Benjamites, burned up the city, and now they're surrounded by all these Israelites. And 25,100 are killed. So while the Benjamites were saying, "We are defeating them as before," the Israelites were saying, "Let's retreat and draw them away from the city." And the men of Israel moved from their places, took up positions at Baal Tamar, and the Israelite ambush charged out of its place on the west of Gibeah. Then 10,000 of Israel's able young men made a frontal attack on Gibeah. The fighting was so heavy that the Benjamites did not realize how near disaster was. They didn't see this ambush coming. They're busy thinking they're winning again. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and on that day, the Israelites struck down 25,100 Benjamites, all armed with swords. Then the Benjamites thought they were beaten. you think? There's only 26,000 of them. And 25, actually, only 600 survived. They killed about 18,000 of them right there on the field. I don't remember the exact number. And then they chased several thousand more. They chased them out into the woods and killed them out there. And they just kept going at it until they... But there were 600 left that ran away. Now, once the Israelites started to think about this, they realized, whoa, we don't want the whole tribe of Benjamin to go away. They're part of God's chosen people. Oh, sure, they messed up, but they're part of God. So believe it or not, they actually find a town, Jabesh Gilead, that hadn't shown up for the fight. And they said, well, those guys didn't show up for the fight. Let's go kill everyone that's not a virgin woman and take the virgins and give them to the Benjamites so they can have wives, procreate, and rebuild the Benjamites. It's weirder, right? Weird story. Okay, so how does this apply to our life? Right? It applies so directly, it's incredible. First of all, the Christian life for each one of us, that's the promised land. And every aspect of our body, soul, mind needs to be occupied in serving God. And it isn't. Every area isn't. And some areas might be partly serving, just like Benjamin. Most of Benjamin might have been serving, but there's this little area over here. So my attitude towards sex and marriage might be pretty good, but there's this little piece over here that's still got eyes that wander. Okay? Or I know what it is to eat good food and so on, but there's a part of me that just wants to pig out all the time. You know, I always thought that Overeaters Anonymous was the toughest bunch, because toughest road to hoe, because you can't just not eat. At least with alcohol or drugs, you can just say, I'm never going to do that again. I'm just not going to do that at all. But with eating, it's a matter of you got to eat the right amount, but you have to eat. And actually, it's not that different from alcohol and drugs, to be honest, because it turns out there's all kinds of things you can abuse and be addicted to. Right now, I'm struggling with a little bit of an addiction to swimming. I think that's the best addiction I've ever had. And yet, my heart has to be right about it. It has to be to the glory of God. So when I'm there showing off my Speedo, my new slim figure, and when I see another guy in the pool and I'm thinking, watch this. You know, what? Man, it's pride, everything, all this stuff. I said pride, lust, you name it. It's all happening. Well, Kent's got his new addiction, right? So when my mind's right about it, I will remember that I'm only wearing that swimsuit because that's what you wear when you swim fast. It's kind of hard to have these big baggy trunks on. And I'll remember that it isn't important whether I'm faster than somebody else or not. And that is a battle that is going on with me. And you know who's lying to me the whole time and saying, oh, no, you do look good and you are better than those guys? Satan, right? And who likes to hear that? Me! Yeah. What? Yeah, they're all looking at you. They're thinking, look at the old guy go, you know? Well, that's just one little thing. What's yours? The thing is, what's really weird when I preach is I know that among you there are addictions, infidelity, there's pride, they're bitter, there's some of you are holding bitterness, somebody that you just can't forgive. You know, I don't know who, by the way, so breathe easy. In most cases, I don't know who, but I know that that's going on, or that you have struggled with it in the past, or you will struggle with it in the future. But I know there's a whole bunch that's going on right now. And that part of you that's resisting is as ugly as that town of Gibeah that wanted to gang rape the guy just because he was visiting, just because he was new, right? It's as ugly as that. And you're as important to God as an individual as the Israelites were as a nation. And you are loved by him the way a mother loves her baby, And the way a mother loves her baby, if she knew there was little cancer eating away part of that baby, she would hate that cancer. And that is the way God looks at those areas that we have in our life. You don't kill the baby because there's that piece of cancer in there. You do whatever it takes. You pay a guy with a knife to cut your baby. I mean, think about it. That's what you do. You pay a guy with a knife to cut your baby. It's a painful, terrible thing, but you know it's the right thing to do to save that child's life. God knows it's the right thing to do to come in and cut out that area of life. Now, you may, like the Benjamites, try to rally around and defend it. And the word that is very popular in the last few decades is denial. You know, no, that's not so bad. Well, that I only did that once in a while, right? I love a thing I heard the other day, denial. Don't even know I am lying. Yeah, that's it. So sometimes you don't even know you're lying. And God, because he loves you, will show you where Gibeah is in your soul. And that's a really important time to say, thank you for showing me that, God, instead of saying, no, it's not that bad. It's okay. You know, that's the difference between conviction and condemnation. Conviction is the doctor saying, we've discovered the cancer and we can cure this child. Condemnation is, oh crap, the kid has cancer. Throw him out. We're not under condemnation. We're under conviction.
Forgot he's on this side. Joseph, well, not...
That's how it applies to us. And when we battle, as is the 11 tribes of is other tribes of Israel did with Benjamin, who was protecting Gibeah, we actually may suffer some big losses. They lost 40,000 soldiers trying to wipe out 25,000 Benjamites. In the struggle in your soul, there's going to be, if there's a really ugly area, there's going to be some wreckage in there as the battle goes on. But as long as God is telling you, you're headed in the right way, keep going, you keep coming back to him and saying, are you sure, God, this is what I'm supposed to do? Yep, keep going. That's all right. That doesn't sound that great for the 40,000 guys that got killed, you know, but that was talking about a nation. Now we're talking about you as an individual. It's just some portion of you that will suffer as a result of fighting the good fight the way God asks you to. So we want to ask God to bless our efforts. We want to ask God very specifically for help. When it comes to the weeping and sacrifice, well, that's just really paying attention. And the sacrifice in those days was how they did worship. So it's praying, worshiping, admitting our powerlessness, and asking God if we're hearing him correctly, just like the Israelites asked God. And God will say, keep on fighting until all the compromises are eliminated. So you want to change your heart. You don't want to become legalistic. So just one last thing. The Bible says, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. But you don't see very many people with hands cut off or eyes gouged. You know what? It doesn't say that your hand causes you to sin. And it doesn't say that. It said if they did, it would be worth it to cut them out. But since that's not what makes you sin, that is not the way to get rid of sin. If your sin is gambling, and you decide that therefore I will not play Uno with my children, that might be a wise thing while you're getting over being addicted to gambling, okay? But if you declare that everybody in New Life Fellowship will never touch a deck of cards, that's legalism, all right? That's not trying to affect the heart. That's just trying to set a rule. If there's no cards involved, they can't gamble, right? Oh, no dice either, you know? Nobody in New Life Fellowship can ever drink anything, you know, except water. Well, what about pop? You know, what about it's the heart. So change the heart don't resort to legalism. Don't say nobody can dance because when you dance, people touch each other. You know, I watched that movie, what's this, with the surfer girl, with the gets her arm, Soul Surfer. And it was a great movie, but I'm an old guy, and the whole time I'm going, there's all these like 14-year-old girls in bikinis. This is a Christian movie? You know, it's like, yes, their heart was fine. This Ken Schnocke maybe was having a little trouble with the fact that there were all these young women in bikinis. But in our culture right now, I really don't think it's probably that big a deal. You know, it was a wholesome movie in its own way. But you have to decide that for yourself. If you can't go see Soul Surfer without going gaga over the girls in bikinis, don't go see it. But don't tell everybody else, and you shouldn't see it either. You know, that's not how it works. That's legalism. So that is how it applies to your life. I've already gone longer than I meant to, and I'm done.